Welcome to Share the Bites, Episode 8. It's Linus. It's Mark. No, it's Jono.
So this is just going to be, how does this work?
Very casual. Typically, I just introduce and then we introduce ourselves around.
Okay.
And then we talk and ask questions. I mean,
cool.
Really.
You'll get a feel for it. We're going
to
get the synergy.
Yeah, to kind of give you an idea, we had this grand plan of, hey, today we're going to be organized. We're going to get here before Jono does, way before. We're going to have our questions laid out. We're going to be interrogating him one after another.
Yeah.
It's going to be a smooth process. But in the end, it turns out to be
this is
nice,
cool.
Casual Friday
here
at Cafe La Scala, DV Lug, and special guest, Jono Bacon. I'm Ian Lynn.
Graham Bowman.
Bethany Doolin.
And another special guest,
Mark Terranova.
Outstanding. Okay. So, I already said Jono's name, so why are you pointing at me?
Oh, okay.
Hello.
My name is Mark Shuttleworth.
Actually, I have less hair and a lot less money, so.
But much more awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Commonwealth accent, something like that.
Now back to the non-fiction part of the broadcast.
What we're going to be discussing today.
The art of community. Because, I mean, we talk about Linux here at DB Lug, open source projects, and Jono, I understand, you're involved with Ubuntu. I mean, Grant brought me on. To be honest, I've only known about you for the last 3 weeks, which meant I bought your book, I read your Wikipedia page, which I hope is mostly true.
I don't know, I haven't read it for a while. It's probably full of lies. So, well, thank you for buying the book.
Yep, and two copies, I might add. So.
That's brilliant. You got to have a backup copy.
Yeah.
Oh, just in case you want to read it twice, right?
One hard copy, one electronic.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, again, it makes the electronic portion makes it a little bit easier reading it on the commute. So.
Yeah.
Granted, I like your book, but I'm not too keen on carrying around 600 pages in my bag along with my lunch, my laptop, and everything else.
It's the second edition is... it's weird because, you know, like when you see it in PDF form and it's however many pages it is, you don't really think about the physical size that it's going to be until, you know, writing a book is a miserable experience, right? You sit there after work every day and you've got to write a certain amount and, you know, it's a very solitary, miserable experience. If anyone's listening to this and you think about writing a book, don't do it. Save yourself. There's always something like the car needs cleaning. Clean your garage out, whatever it might be. Just don't write a book. It's depressing.
Is it like a homework assignment where your publisher says you must meet such and such amount of pages? Or do you set that goal yourself?
Well, usually what they do is they say, this is the amount. So usually what happens is they say, okay, we want you to write a book on this. Or an author might go to the publisher and say, can I write a book on this? And then they'll say, okay, the page count is usually around this. And then you put together like the kind of content that you want to put in there. For the second edition of this, they said, you know, how many pages do you want to write? And I said, well, I'm thinking about 150, but I just completely plucked that number out of thin air. And I had no real consideration about how big the actual item was going to be. And you spent, you know, 6 months writing this thing, and like I say, after work every night, just plowing through it, hating life, all for that moment when that box arrives 6 months later, and it's filled with copies of the book, and you open it up, and you leaf through it, and you think, wow. Check it out. That's pretty cool, you know. That's
pretty
cool. And then that moment lasts for about 5 minutes, and then you think to yourself, okay, that was that then. 6 minutes of my life. But I'm really happy with it. I mean,
have you gotten a lot of feedback on it?
I mean, so far the feedback seems to be pretty positive. I was terrified for the first edition because there wasn't really a book like this out there. I mean, there was academic books about the idea of like community building and urban regeneration and stuff like that. But there hadn't really been something on this topic, and I was nervous about whether it was going to make sense because like a lot of the topics in the book, you know, like if you're teaching programming, for example, before you teach someone about functions, you've got to teach them about variables, you've got to teach them about core constructs. there's a linear path in which you teach people. With community management, there isn't a path. You know, to do one thing, you've got to know something else they might not have covered yet, but to know that thing, you've got to know something later on. So it's a real nest of different things that are intermingled. And the thing that was the hardest thing about writing that book was figuring out the flow in which they go from one step to the next. And I was nervous that if you get that organization wrong, it's just going to be confusing. So I was really nervous about whether people were going to like it. But the first edition people liked. Second edition, I was nervous again. People seemed to like it. So, yeah. Hope you like it, people.
Oh, yeah. And Jonna, I was very intrigued. And I just wanted to ask you a few questions. Why do you think so many people struggle building a community?
Good question. I mean, I think every community is different, you know? Every community is very different. You have... you might have an online software community like Ubuntu or Fedora. You might have a local book club, a Linux user group, whatever it might be. But I think the core social conditions of how a community works are the same. Like, you want to build belonging in people. You want to make people feel valued. You want them to have stuff to do, to have the knowledge to contribute in different ways. But the specifics of those areas varies. Like, the way in which you build a community in a big enterprise, like an internal architectural design community inside of an organization, is going to be very different how you build an open source community. I think people struggle because there isn't a science to this yet. I mean, you know, one thing I've been talking about recently is I think we're entering the renaissance of community management, which is the way I learned a lot of this was through just watching other people and how they did things and soaking up their experience and trying to expose myself to different areas so I could kind of pool that together with my own ideas and then approach my work in that way. Now people are starting to write stuff down, and that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to write down a community, was to write down at least one guy's idea of how it works. And most of the content in the Art of Community is actually things I've learned from other people and things I've seen. It's full of stories. But now we're getting into this renaissance where people are writing things down, they're talking about this. You know, the Community Leadership Summit every year is there to do this. So I think now it's becoming easier because people can share these experiences. But it is hard. I mean, it's hard depending. Different communities do it in radically different ways. In open source, we think that's the common mantra of how we do things in community, but it's actually quite weird compared to most other communities from what I've seen.
So you're just coming back from the Community Leadership Summit in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
OzCon. You have a busy schedule, obviously. You're flying around the world all over the place. What else is keeping you busy these days?
The travel has kind of let up quite a bit. When I lived in England, I didn't really like where I lived. So I liked traveling because it meant that I wasn't at home. So it meant that I, you know, being in hotels and hanging around with cool people was nice, as opposed to being at home in the West Midlands. Now I live in the Bay Area. I really like where I live, so I don't like traveling anymore. It's a real bore, like, having to travel.
You'd rather be barbecuing, huh?
I'd rather be at home barbecuing, you know, and hanging out with my friends here. So I don't really travel as much as I used to. Like, when I started out at Canonical, I used to be away for 5-6 weeks at a time, and that was great. It was depressing getting back. I mean, good grief. It's like, I'm glad you don't have guns in England, because after 6 weeks with interesting people and great food, it's just me and my cooking. Life sucks. But recently, you know, there's been bits of traveling here and there, lots of work going on with Ubuntu, lot of effort with app developers. That's the area. I believe this is a really critically important part of where we should be focusing on Ubuntu. And we've got a long road to travel. I think we've built, you know, quality and cadence in Ubuntu, and we've tried to really focus on those areas. But we need to make it easy for people to get their apps in Ubuntu, and we're spending a lot of time building a spec for how we can do this, how we can make it easy for app developers to get their content in without the bottlenecks and the problems that we've had traditionally. And it's a cultural shift in Ubuntu. It's a cultural shift from people building an operating system to empowering app developers who might not care about that operating system to get their content in as well. So there's been lots of stuff going on at Ubuntu. Second edition of the book has come out, you know, there's
a lot of interviews,
the book's got
second life.
Book's got like 14 interviews in there.
Linus Torvalds, Mike Shinoda, Martin Mikos, Mike Linksayer, Tim O'Reilly.
Yeah.
I figured that these famous people are more likely to sell the book than I am, so it's a theory, you know. If you think about it, it's a great idea because you get famous people who add content to the book and they write the pages.
Well, a teacher once told me to be successful, you don't necessarily need to be brilliant, you just surround yourself by brilliant people.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that, you know. Hence why, you know, I'm here tonight.
Oh,
oh, you better suck up to the people doing the podcast.
You said Mike Linksfair, is that who, from Creative Commons?
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit more about Creative Commons, because I know that your music is under Creative Commons, and it's something that, as much as I love Linux, first and foremost, I put Creative Commons because it's culture. So say some more about Creative Commons and its awesomeness.
I'm a big fan of the Creative Commons. I just think it's the right way to do things. So the Art of Community is licensed under a Creative Commons license. My band, Severed Fifth, which Grant is representing, this man can headbang.
Hardcore.
I'm the other laundry was dirty, so, you know.
Oh, come on, dude. Oh man, shut down in flames. Severed Fifth, I mean the idea of Severed Fifth was, you know, to create a band that does all the music under a free culture license.
Change the music industry.
And that's been a really interesting experience from lots of perspectives. When I started, the idea of Severed Fifth was to basically say, okay, when you're a nobody, when you're a nobody, it's hard to sell records, right? So if you give your music away for free and people can share your music, you can arguably build a reputation, and then people come to your shows and they buy your t-shirts. Like, most bands make money from merchandise, they don't make money from albums. So that's how you can pay your, you know, your rental space fees and all that kind of stuff. The thing I've discovered is that if you are a weekend warrior like I am, like, I don't want to be a rock star, I don't want a record deal, I have no interest in going on tour with a band. So it works out really well because you get people who listen to music and they enjoy it and all the rest of it. If you are, you know, if you're living in central Oakland and you're playing in a band and that's what you do for your career, it's very different, you know, to essentially say, I'm giving up this content and a potential paycheck so people can have it for free, particularly with the culture of music increasingly being people just want to download stuff for free off the internet. So my viewpoint at one point was, irrespective of the circumstances, Creative Commons is the right way to do things. My views changed a little bit in the sense that I've met a lot of musicians in the Bay Area, and their career is playing in music, they're playing in bands, and it's a frugal industry to be in. There's not a lot of money on the table. If you don't get paid that $150 at the end of a show, then you haven't got gas money, right? It's very different for me when I've got a day job, and it doesn't matter if I get the gas money, I'm just having fun playing gigs.
And the gas is going up.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Creative Commons generally is the right... The thing I like about the Creative Commons is that it empowers people like me, who are weekend warriors, to do things and to feel like accomplished in what you're doing. You know, and we had a campaign, you know, we raised $5,000 from the community to record the album, and we gave the album away for free, and people seem to enjoy that. It's a good way of working. So, like, for musicians who don't necessarily want to make a big career of it, I think it's a great way of doing things. I'm not 100% convinced as I used to that it's the way in which you can make a full career out of it, because it's not proven yet.
Yep. Now, you started as a solo act, and then you built the band since you've been here in the Bay Area for how long now have you been here?
I've been here for nearly 4 years. Yeah. Seriously. No, it's...
How do the other band members think about that? Sort of the band right now? And how's it going?
It's going well. I mean, things have changed. I mean, it's...
Being bands in a, have a life of their own.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, you go through... Like anything, you go through phases, you know. Like, you'll have a quiet time in a band, and that's fine. And then you'll go through a really intense period. We've been very lucky in the fact that we've had like a bunch of really great shows. Like, you know, we got to support a bunch of bands that we're fans of, like got to support Exodus and, you know, Dublin Death Patrol, a bunch of other bands. In fact, we're playing on a warship in August. We're playing a Slot by the Water music festival. We're playing on the USS Hornet in
Alameda,
yeah,
which is
nice.
Pretty yeah. badass.
Oh, it's great.
And that's cool, you know. But we've been very lucky. But frankly, my main interest is not so much playing shows. I just like being in a room with a bunch of other sweaty people and playing loud music.
Well, that sounds like the
mug meetings
in England.
That's exactly what it's like.
I mean, and the music was tied to that. I mean, talk about Jono at it. You know, just...
Oh, my God.
Combining
oh
two passions
Oh, my God,
I'd
forgotten
once.
About that.
So this is a really weird story. When we were doing Lug Radio, this podcast, it was... people would... You know, I used to record it in Windows, and naturally... Lug Radio. People didn't like that. And I used to get grief every week on the forums. Why aren't you recording this in Ardour or whatever else? And my response was quite simple. Like, I don't want to learn rocket science to edit my podcast. I don't know what you guys edit this in, but I'm sure you don't want to necessarily learn some kind of incredibly complicated...
Yeah, I have a set of tools. Granted, it's for Windows. It works. And around here, we've always talked about use the right tool for the right job.
Exactly.
And right now, the right tool that I have exists on Windows.
Yeah.
But after reading your book, it's like, oh, you have now an app that meant for podcasts. I said, well, maybe in the spirit of things, well, I'm going to use Audacity to edit the individual WAV files, clean up the noise, and then use your app, Jacosher.
Right, right.
To put the all the WAV files together and create the podcast.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
the spirit of open source.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, I was accused of not being in the spirit of open source because I was recording and editing on Windows because Cubase I've been using for years recording music and it worked. Ardour, much as I'm really good friends with a guy who created Ardour and he's a cool guy, but he's trying to replace Pro Tools, which is a professional studio engineering tool. I'm not a professional engineer by any stretch of the imagination, so I sat with my cantankerous friend Ack in England and we were like, well, we should design and create a new one. So we had this idea and originally it was people on the forum saying, okay, well, if you don't like the open source options, what would you want in the new one? So I basically worked with Ack and we put together a bunch of mock-ups and just posted the forums. I said, look, I don't have time to write this, I'm too busy with work. This is my dream editor. And people, like the following day, someone had landed a bizarre branch with a window that looked a little bit like one of my mock-ups, and they called it Jono Edit. And I thought, that's really cool. So I started thinking, I wouldn't mind getting back into programming. So we started building this. But I said, like, we have to call it something else. We can't call it Jono Edit. That's ridiculous. So we were talking, like, well, what can it be called? You know, we're trying to figure out what's going to be a good name. And someone suggested Jacosha, who's actually one of the X-Lug radio presenters. I was like, that's a cool sound. Like, what does it mean? And he said, well, kosher is... You can't have bacon. Like, kosher is no bacon, so Joe, no bacon. I was like, oh, man. Are you kidding me? But then one part of my brain was thinking, Jacosha is like a made-up word. It's got Google juice, right? So that's pretty cool. So we ended up sticking with that in the end, and it became its own thing.
So how long did it take from the initial idea to it actually, you would say, being usable?
It was weird because Jacosha was one of the things that I wrote in the thing that I wanted to see with an audio editor is that it uses GStreamer. Because one of the problems with Jack, which is what Ardour uses, is that it's a bit of a pain to set up and use. At the time it was. It's much easier now. It's much more integrated now. But GStreamer was like the modern way of doing things for essentially consumer use of audio. The problem was is that what we wanted to do with Jacosha was really pushing GStreamer to the limits. So GStreamer is this really really comprehensive audio framework, but for doing non-linear editing, which is what we were doing, you know, we wanted to do non-destructive editing. So essentially what you're doing is you're storing a data structure of essentially time cuts that need to be replayed back in real time. And there's a guy called Edward Hervey who was building Pitavi at the time, and he created this software called Genonlin, which was basically a library for doing this. But he created it for Pitavi, and no one else was using Genonlin, and we were the only people who were using it. So we built this editor, and yeah, that website's so out of date.
For those of you listening who can't actually see it,
yeah.
Grant pulled up
Go
the website.
Yeah.
So the problem was is that, like, so we built this like GUI framework, but no one had wanted to actually put the gloves on and actually build the audio engine. So I was like, all right, I'll have a go at doing it.
and I built the GStreamer support, the first go of the GStreamer support into Jacocia. And it was hard work, but I came up with bug after bug after bug because no one had used Gene Online before. No one had really used GStreamer for this. Like, you know, GStreamer was usually things like Totem, you know, it's just a linear waveform that's playing. We have like these big comprehensive T's in these waveforms, and you know, you've got sound going, you've got a waveform playing, but you're going through multiple effects, and you've got to convert between different formats. So it became really complicated. So it just took a while for GStreamer to have some of the bugs shaken out. So it took about 6 or 8 months before it was vaguely useful. We got there in the end. I'd forgotten about Jacocia. It's been a while.
Okay, John, I have a question for you. If you had to pick one thing out of your book that you would like people to remember and gain, just one thing out of your book,
okay,
what would that be?
So one thing out of my book that you'd want people to gain. Good question.
I mean, I know it's picking out of a 600-page book, right?
I can hand you the book, and you can just flip through it and write your figure out the page. Yeah.
Every page is gold.
Every page is gold. You're just feeling guilty about that comment about your T-shirt.
How about don't be a D-bag?
There is that, yeah. I'd say that probably the main thing I'd probably pick out is it's not massively specific, but to me, that book is filled with all kinds of details of things that you can do to build a community in different aspects, conflict resolution, don't be a D-bag, governance and events, all that kind of stuff. But to me, it all boils down to the thing that we do, the reason why we build communities and the reason how we build strong communities and strong community members who thrive is we have to build a sense of belonging in people. Everything boils down to that in my mind. Like, yeah, exactly. The thing that we want to avoid in communities is what I call drive-by contributors, which is people who show up and they're really motivated and excited, and you invest a ton of effort and resources in helping to give them the skills and stuff to do. They stick around for a week and a half and then they disappear. Those people are I call them expensive to train up because it takes a lot of volunteer time, or if you've got a community manager, paid time to help get them up to speed. And then you don't get significant and sustained contributions out of them. In reality, we want people to feel like they're part of something, and then they stick around, and then you get more value out of them. To make them stick around, we have to make them feel like they belong, like they feel like that they're an indispensable part of the project. And building belonging is one element, but you also don't want to build entitlement. When people feel like, oh, well, you're nothing without me, bad karma at that point. So, like, to me, the one thing would be, what are we doing in our communities to help people feel like they're part of something? Whether it's DV Lug, or they're part of Ubuntu, or Fedora, or Debian, or whatever, I don't care what it is. You want people to feel like, you want them to feel excited about contributing because they feel like part of a family that's doing something. That to me is that's the most important lesson from the book.
I think I remember reading the word team, and kind of,
yeah,
everybody was a team.
You had said something about the accomplishments, and I know you've been working on an accomplishment system.
Yeah.
Can you give a couple more examples of how it works and how that's a direct, measurable way to see what people are actually doing?
Yeah, sure.
And that sort of
thing. This has been really fun to work on. It started out when I went to a community manager's lunch at eBay, and I was hanging out with a few people, and I think it was Van from Google asked the question. He said, you know, how does Ubuntu acknowledge people's contributions? And I realized that we don't really have a very good way of doing this. We just rely on people being nice to each other and saying thank you.
You need something more than a thank you and have a nice day?
Yeah, and it was kind of grating away at me. I was driving home. It actually put me in a pretty bad mood. I was like, I'm doing a really bad job, aren't I? You know, because we don't really have a scalable way of doing this. People talk a lot about gamification is the new trend in community management, and I'd heard a bit about gamification, but I didn't really know what it was. But I like the idea of building some kind of system where you could make it easier to find things to do in the community, whether it's translating or filing a bug or fixing a bug or whatever it might be, but to also acknowledge those contributions with little trophies. Because people, I think when people get something, acknowledgement, even if it's automated, they feel good about it. It's not for everybody, but some people feel good about it. So again, Stuart Langridge, the guy who I spent many hours designing Jokosha with, he was visiting over here with his daughter, and we sat down. I said to him, look, I want to build some kind of trophy system for Ubuntu, but I have all these outstanding questions, and you're my guy who I speak to when I have these stupid ideas. In the same way that when he has stupid ideas, he rings me up. So we came up with the system, and it's decentralized. You know, we didn't want to build one system that basically acknowledges, that knows everything about everybody, because that's weird. We wanted a system in which you can browse things that you can do in the community in your language, and then it will automatically know when you've done something. So like, for example, it should detect when you've filed your first bug. It should detect when you've translated something for the first time, and then you get a little trophy to acknowledge that. So we built this kind of like, we sat there, and it took us about 4.5 hours and then about 19 cups of tea, and then we came up with this idea, and I documented this into a spec. And I was really busy at the time. I said to him, I'm not going to have the time to work on this, and he didn't have the time. So I basically threw out there and said, look, if anyone's interested, a lot of the thinking's been done here, knock yourselves out. And no one paid attention. Be like, don't care. And then my wife went away for 2 weeks to Spain, and my life was now a life of lean cuisine and Cheetos.
But unadulterated freedom?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, okay, well, I wouldn't mind. I was every 6 months I get the itch to do some programming, and I thought, I'll do some programming. And so I built the first cut of the system, and it's now turned into this really fun project. But it was dividing for some people. Like, some people just really don't like the idea of trophy systems for communities. They feel like it's an affront to the community. And usually the reason for that is because a lot of these kind of like trophies or badges systems are pretty stupidly designed. Like, if you look at PHBBB as an example, people get little badges when they've posted a certain number of times, and that's stupid. Like, just because you've posted 500 posts doesn't mean you're necessarily worthy. You could have posted 500 links to cats with guitars, you know. It's doesn't necessarily mean there's any content in there. So we have this. And this was part of the system, was like exploring what we want to define as our values in it, which is we don't have accomplishments in the system for traffic. We have accomplishments for new experiences and new skills. So like, you'll get an accomplishment for, I filed my first book, because that's a new skill. Or I've become a member of the community council, that's a skill. And we have accomplishments for if you've done significant sustained contributions, which is the mantra of Ubuntu membership.
So in a way, that also encourages people to grow and increase their skill levels. So let me learn something else out there to better myself.
Exactly, and I think part of the challenge here as well is that it's very difficult for community managers to understand what the new community experience is, because you've been boiled in this brine of your community for so long. But one of the conclusions I was coming to was, we don't have a good way of mapping out the journey. Like, if you want to get involved as an Ubuntu developer, you first need to register a Launchpad account, and then you need to probably find a bug, and then you need to fix that bug, and then you need to add it to the sponsorship queue, and then you need to get that reviewed, and you want to join these particular, you need to know which IRC channels to join, which mailing lists to join. You need to know what the conduct is that is expected. There's all this detail, and no one lays that out on a platter for you, and the accomplishment system actually says, before you can get this accomplishment, you need to complete this one first. And each one has got documentation about pitfalls and tips and tricks and where to find help and this kind of stuff. So it maps out the journey a little bit. And then you can also say, I've done this, and this is my trophy cabinet, and these are the things I've done. It represents you and the community a little bit.
So it's not just about specific rewards for specific tasks, but it's within a framework and gives a roadmap for individual contributors, on-ramp.
Right? The on-ramp, exactly. On-ramp. And that's, it's funny, I went to OSCON and CLS, and I did a talk about this at CLS, and I was referring to it as gamification, because I was thinking, everyone was going on about gamification, and people started emailing me saying, well, now you're building a gamification platform, like, what do you think about this? And I didn't really realize that it was a gamification platform, because I, you know, but gamification, I didn't think about it that way. I thought about, this is about defining opportunities in the community and acknowledging those opportunities.
Well, if you implement it well, it hits so many different topics of your chapter headings in your book. I was just looking through the table of contents, it is a plan, right? You are communicating clearly with the rest of the people in your group. It's a process.
Right.
It's very clearly defined. It is supporting workflow with the tools.
Yeah.
Those are just the chapter headings in your book. I mean, it hits
things.
And if you implement it well, then, you know, but the details are very, very important to do it. Right?
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's weird. The more I heard about this kind of gamification stuff, and the more I thought, I did this presentation about how this was a good example of gamification. Then after the presentation, I talked with some people about it. I realized that it really isn't gamification because I'm not building a game here. I then started telling everybody, actually, you know how I said this was a gamification system? I was wrong. Like, this isn't gamification. I don't want to build a gamification system. This is acknowledgement and opportunity. So, like, the critics, and there are critics who don't like it, I think they're criticizing it based upon the premise of the unintelligent gamification of, like, 500 forums posts. That's the way I kind of see it. And, you know, no one's forced to use it. If you don't like it, don't use it. So it's kind of the way I see it.
Where do you display your trophies and stuff? I mean, do you have a link to it? Are you able to link it with other things yet?
So when we did the first cut of the 0.1 release, there's a back-end daemon that does all the work. And then you can have multiple viewers, multiple clients that talk to have it. Basically, I wrote it as a Dbus interface. So you could write, like, the default client is a GTK client that integrates into Ubuntu. There's a Unity lens where you can see all your trophies as well. You could write a Qt version if you wanted to, whatever. It doesn't really matter. You could write a Windows client if you wanted. 0.2, we fixed a bunch of bugs and matured the system. For the new version that's coming out, 0.3, it's going to come out in September. We wanted to be able to publish these online. So you can go to trophies.ubuntu.com/JonoBacon, as an example, and see, I can see my trophy cabinet. Now, again, some of the critics were worried that this may turn into leaderboards. And I've made it very clear to people, I do not want to pit community members against community members. I don't want this to be a who is the most worthy competition. I want to instead turn this into a social network for community members. So when you go and see, so let's say Mark Terranova gets the I'm an Ubuntu member accomplishment, and I'm looking at his accomplishment for that, it should say, check out these other people who got this accomplishment as well, and provide a means in which they can get in touch with each other. And then that unites people who've got similar interests, and I think that's a good way to do it.
And allows you to know what people's skill set is one of the important things. If someone solved 100 bugs, and you can see that visualized, you know, oh yeah, I've got a bug question, I'm comfortable asking them this, or someone else's,
exactly.
You know, oh, your specialty is wiki, I don't have one of those questions. And that sort of thing does make sense, and it sort of lets people know who to talk to, and especially if it's not a competition.
Well, that's the thing. And we
benefits, and it's an opt-in thing. You don't have to do this. This isn't something that
that's the thing. And part of the reason why I have a strong opinion about not making this a leaderboard competition thing, is because we did that once before, and it was a terrible idea. Like, and this is all my fault. I had this stupid. I just moved to the US, and I said to one of the guys on my team at Canonical, I was like, I've got this brilliant idea. We should have hallofame.ubuntu.com.
I remember this.
You remember this?
Yeah.
Dude, it was all my fault. I'm taking full blame for this. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to make people feel good like I'm at the top of the leaderboard? And it turns out that for the top 10 people, they feel really good about it. For the other 300 people in this particular leaderboard, such as developers, don't feel quite so good about it. And it was a stupid idea. But it was a necessary learning experience. I thought of it very much in the positive light of making people feel good about their significant contributions to the project, as opposed to making other people feel inferior by the fact that they weren't perceived as being as good as somebody else.
Like being in kindergarten, not having a lot of stars.
Yeah, exactly. it really tapped into a lot of people's insecurities, put it that way. I'm much more interested in celebrating an individual's contributions and connecting them with other people.
I had a question about the Creative Commons license.
This
kind of goes towards what you're talking about, recognizing contributions, and that in your book you're talking about releasing software under Creative Commons, it's beneficial for both you and other people out there, because let's say you write a program, you release it out there,
and then people make updates to it, improvements. And so now you have access to those improvements, so what you want to do is increased.
Yeah, totally.
So how does that translate to other media, like your book? I mean, did you get, by this being licensed Creative Commons, are you able to incorporate other people that things that people add to it? Or right. like your music, I mean, does that work for all media or a few things?
I get the impression it depends on the media. So it's a really interesting question because using the book as an example, nobody's come up to me and said, here's a patch, you know, for this chapter. You know, like, nice try, English man, but here's a patch to improve it, you know. No one's done that, but I think the reason why that is because the book is not a release often kind of thing. It's like, I think a lot of people saw the first edition, it's carved in stone, it's not going to change, there's no point in me patching it because there's not going to be, like, first edition 0.1 is going to come out. Unlike software, which software's iterating every day. And it's the same thing with the music, like the music is to a degree burned in stone when you release an album. The thing that was interesting about the music was that people wrapped around it, like people did wallpapers and logos and fanzines and all that kind of stuff. And people haven't really done that with the book. Like, I think people felt more connected to the music because the music is much more of the idea of being a fan with music is much more predominant than the idea of being a fan. Like, I don't think people get as crazy about authors as they do about bands. It's just the nature of the medium. And with software, it's very, very common to, even if you don't ask for it, people send you a patch. I mean, and that's one of the things that that's really empowering about open source. I've been involved in open source for 14 years now, and I always forget how much fun it is starting a software project. Like, it's the most fun thing I think you can do. Like, it's awesome. But it's really lonely as well until other people get involved.
And, well, how do you keep people involved? That's, I guess, a real question. Because, again, you're talking about you have people who contribute a lot and then they disappear.
Yeah.
But then you have people who work on a project and they're consistent about it, but eventually they burn out.
Yeah.
So how do you make the project bigger than yourself, per se? Because, I mean, your time is valuable as well.
Yeah,
I mean, the accomplishment system is really good for a large community, but what about those small communities?
Yeah, I mean, it's
when you think about with Severed Fifth, there is an IRC channel, which is Severed Fifth. It's on Freenode.
Yeah,
and it's had more members and then some less members. But what made me think about that is when you're talking about user created stuff, there's a fair amount of videos on YouTube that are Severed Fifth. To video games being played, picture, I mean, just all sorts of things being done. And it does that. But it's something that there's a certain point that there's a community. I spend time in that channel also, of people that actually interact. And it's like, hey, how's it going? And there's one of the guys that is going through physical therapy and actually is in a wheelchair and going through the strength. So it's really neat that it's beyond just the music and stuff. There's this community that's sort of formed around.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I know it was a lot more work at first, and now it's more like, oh, all right, cool, there's still some, you guys are still here, excellent.
I think that's the thing, like, to me, like, with communities, you want to, ultimately, you want the community to be able to stand on its own feet. Like, every community starts out with somebody who is banging the drum. Like, Linus Torvalds with Linux, it was just him. He was fighting the cause, you know? He was putting all the effort in, and then, before long,
before him.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then before long, people started joining, and then Linus could take the foot off the gas a little bit, still be involved, still be seen as the spiritual leader, essentially, of that project. But
would you say that it's necessary to reach a certain critical mass, though, in order for it to keep on going like that?
Well, I think that's the challenge. I mean, like I mentioned earlier on about it being a lonely time. It really is. I mean, Ubuntu Accomplishments was a great reminder of this for me. I hadn't written a software project for a few years, and you start out, and Ubuntu Accomplishments was by far the biggest project I've ever worked on. I mean, it's massive in terms of the moving parts. Like, in the past, I've worked on Jacosha was big, but it wasn't that big. It was just complex, and it was complex because a lot of the underlying hardware, the underlying software, audio engine was new and different. Ubuntu Accomplishments has got, like, you know, it's got a back-end daemon, and it's got a viewer, and it's got a validation server, and it's got, like, a new standard that we had to build, and all the documentation, and this, that, and the other. And that was... just defining all these moving pieces was complex, and in terms of community members getting involved, a community member is probably only going to be interested in a piece of that. Like, just, I'm just interested in the viewer, or I'm just interested in the back end, or whatever it might be. So, like, when I was hacking on it and it was just me, it was fun and it was motivating. Like, those 2 weeks when Eric was traveling, I basically didn't do anything else other than programming. I mean, I was working during the day, and then as soon as I finished work, I was hacking until 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. I was just completely obsessed with it to get it working. But then you get to a point and you're tired and, like, you feel like you're the only one who's banging the drum. The thing that kept me going, and note to everybody who's listening to this, if you see somebody who's working on an open source project, say something nice about it on Google Plus or Twitter or Facebook, because for me personally, that was really motivating. Yeah, when I posted a blog entry about it and said, this is what I've done so far, and people liked it on Google Plus, it's amazing how much currency that has.
Like, knowing people care.
Just knowing people care. Like, having one person saying, this is really cool, keep up the good work, was tremendously motivating. When you're, all you're doing is fighting your way through this code to try and get there. But then, like, you hit this middle, this is where most open source projects, I think, hit a roadblock, is where that motivation starts wearing thin, and people aren't giving you enough kind of validation, and then you think, oh God, I can't be bothered, I'm gonna go and play my PlayStation. I think social media is good for that. Social media keeps things rolling. The thing that was really exciting, this is when I'd forgotten what this was like to be, when, as a from a development perspective, but there's a guy called Rafael Sislik who joined the project, and he started contributing branches, and getting your first branch was incredible, and it, like, so much fun, like, people joining and writing code, and then it was just him and I for a reasonable chunk of time who were doing most of the work. And then I just thought, like, we need to get to a point where we build the scale out, like, we turn this into a project that lots of people can join. And it's hard work, like, it doesn't accidentally happen. Like, we had to write documentation, like, I wrote tons of documentation about how to help with translations, how to help with documentation, how to help with hacking. You know, when someone joins as a programmer, they need bugs to work on, so setting up bite-sized bugs, producing an architectural overview of the system and how it works. Because it's very easy for me to think, oh, I'm just going to add this small feature, this new addition to the spec, and then not bother documenting it. And then when somebody joins as a developer, they have no idea what's going on. It's really hard for them to carry on documenting the code, commenting the code. All of this required a huge amount of work, and that's what we've been working on recently. We did, like, Google Plus tutorial videos this week just to help people. So it is a lot of work, but and it seems like boring work, but it's worthwhile when people do start participating.
Now, part of that is, since you're starting the project yourself, I mean, you definitely feel ownership of it.
Yeah.
At one point, do you feel like you're losing ownership and you're wondering, do I need to take more control, or do you just say, hey, this is exciting, have at it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, some people, I mean, are very protective of it. I mean, you're creating it. It's a piece of you, in a sense, and what some people would say, but how do you balance that?
Yeah, it's a really delicate balance in my mind. Because in my mind, you want to strike the balance between great leadership, but giving people the freedom to feel like they're part of it, to feel like they belong. And my view here has always been that sometimes the most motivating and empowering things that can happen are when somebody proves that your original idea was actually stupid. and this guy, Rafa, when he joined, He's never said that's stupid. He's just said, maybe we could do it this way. And I really wanted to build an environment in which, if nothing else, we always have a discussion about it. We always sit down and say, well, what's our best option here? And many times I've been proven that my original idea wasn't the right way of doing things. And that's great, but you've got to balance that out with having some leadership and also, like, holding your ground sometimes. Like, there's been some times in the project when I see this all the time in open source. Why did you remove that button? You know, why didn't you put that in as an option? We see this all the time with Unity, right? We see this with GNOME. Why are you taking all these features out? Because each feature that you include in the code base is technical debt. And technical debt means you need maintainers. And when you don't have maintainers for technical debt, then bad software is developed. And so, like, we've been pretty hardcore about saying, we're taking it out. because it's not necessary, it's not helping us, particularly when there's like three guys who are working on the project as core developers. We have three core developers. You know, there's Rafael Sieslik, there's Matt Fisher and myself. And so I think you've got to kind of be a leader, but you've also got to, you've got to be a leader, but you've also got to make sure that you give people the opportunity to feel like they're part of something, like they can participate in all the rest of it. It's and I don't know. I certainly haven't mastered it, but I think a big chunk of that is just saying to people, like, this is our project. Like, this is something that we're doing, and you have every right and every opportunity to be part of this. So.
Isn't that where the magic happens, where, you know, you could step away from a project and it still go on? Where
yeah.
You've literally given birth to something.
Yeah. And, well, they do say a good manager is one who can walk away, not be there, and the work still gets done.
Yeah.
If you have a good plan in the beginning, people have that flexibility to work within certain areas and not interact with others in ways that's not going to be productive. So I think that's, you know, why you started out with that in the book, right, chapter two.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's really surprised me, and this has been a learning lesson, is... there's been like a big, because this is, like I say, it's quite a wide project. There's been many areas where we don't have time. Like, for example, this web UI for this, so you can share your trophies online. We don't have the resources to do this. We're busy working on the core system. The thing that I learned was, if you write a detailed spec with mock-ups and all the details of how this could work and encourage people to participate, it's amazing how many people will be interested in doing that, because they've got a good they've got something to work from. They've got a playbook to work from.
You've been involved with Ubuntu and Canonical long enough that you've been able to see people go from being new contributors, or, I mean, not just new users, to actually being able to contribute on things. I think that a lot of that's been accelerated by Juju Charms, as far as people just being able to get in and at the end of a day being able to have something that sort of works. Have you seen that the process speed up as you guys have made things easier for people to contribute and sort of have more of a framework for teaching? Or what's the process, and then has it gotten quicker, I guess?
I think things are getting better. I think we're learning more and more as time goes on about the kind of things that people need to participate and to feel enthusiastic about that. And we're still, like, screwing things up. I mean, it's like anything. Community management, in my mind, it's an evolving science. You know, there is a renaissance happening, and part of the renaissance is producing bad art, you know?
figuring it out, yeah.
But I feel like as the time's going on, and I'm really fortunate about that, I've got a wonderful team who work for me at Canonical. I mean, George Castro, Michael Hall, Daniel Holback, David Planella, Nick Skaggs. You know, it's an awesome team, and they're very open to trying new things and learning from their mistakes, and I think that's a big chunk of it. And not only that, but learning from other communities about how the communities do it. A lot of the most successful things in Ubuntu, we've completely stolen from other places, because, you know, that's the best way in which community grows, is that you learn from people and you try things and you admit when you're wrong and try to evolve from it. Like, Hall of Fame, stupid idea. Hands up.
Yeah. So, John, have you decided what your next book is going to be about?
I have an idea, actually, for something.
Share it with us, please.
It's a stupid idea, though. So, one thing that always amazes me is when you go to the movies, or you watch a movie at home, and this is the project management dork in me speaking, but I'll watch this movie, and you see all of this, like, CGI, and acting, and casting, and directorship, and all of these things come together in this one unit that's 2.5 hours long, whatever. And you see the credits, you see this massive list of credits. And I always think to myself, it's incredible how these people came together. All these people came together and built this thing. Or it's the same thing with gaming. Like, hundreds of people work together on a video game and they ship it. I think a book on how these people do that would be really interesting. Like, interviews with directors and video game people. I'd like to write that.
Sounds interesting.
George Lucas? And other directors,
right. Yeah.
The area locals.
Yeah, exactly. This is a good place to
start.
This is a good place to write.
Good
start.
Start
Fox City area is Hollywood North.
Maybe MC Hammer.
There we go.
How did you create those trousers?
So as we wrap things up,
Would you have any parting words or sage advice for those who are listening? Certainly it's a great time to put in shameless plugs, for one.
Buy your book?
Temptation to plug, but trying to be classy. You said it. Your words, not mine.
Buy Art of the Community. That's excellent. Electronic and printed version.
Keep talking. Yeah.
And, well, you've done other books, too. Didn't you do a MySQL book or something?
Oh, God, yes. It's a terrible book.
There's a MySQL book, too.
All you need to do is look up John O'Bacon on Google, Amazon, wherever.
Severed Fifth, buy swag t-shirts. The show notes will have Grant and his Severed Fifth shirt also.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only message I'd say is for everybody who's listening to this to just keep doing what you're doing, really. I mean, you know, there's lots of cool stuff you can do in the world, and I guess my only thing that, based on my discussion earlier on with Mark, is people can get a lot further with sugar instead of vinegar, so be nice to each other. And just keep doing what you're doing. That's all I'd say.
Well said.
Well said.
Right. Well, thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great conversation. I'm Ian Lynn.
Grant Bowman.
Bethany Doolin.
Mark Terranova.
And Mark Shuttleworth.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.